Hello and welcome to the Karate Priest Podcast. I'm your host, Father Daniel Duplantis. I'm a martial artist, musician, airman, and a priest of the Diocese of Houma Thibodeau. One of my other passions in life is teaching, especially teaching about the Catholic faith. Catholicism is a very deep faith. Jesus himself told Peter to put out into the deep for a catch. The most significant answers to life's most important questions often lie deep beneath the surface. Many people have questions about their faith. Through this podcast, my aim is to explore these questions and encounter incredible people along the way. Their stories show that God is constantly at work in our lives every single day, sometimes in the ordinary and sometimes in the extraordinary. Some of the topics treated in this podcast may be sensitive or controversial, but their discussion holds the key to truly living as God created us to live, which is to say that He created us to live in authentic freedom, loving Him above all else. Thank you for joining me on this journey of faith, and I hope you enjoy this podcast. Hey guys, and welcome back to the Karate Priest. And by the way, Merry Christmas. This is Christmas Eve, and so it's great to have this final episode of 2021. And gosh, what a year it's been, you know, with continuing the COVID pandemic on my end here in Louisiana with Hurricane Ida and all the hardships that that has brought. Here we come to this really final episode of 2021. And I guess just to kind of wrap things up a bit with this year, we have a bunch of questions that have been given to us through our social media pages. And so today we'd just like to take an opportunity to do some Q&A and answer some of these questions. With that, I have with me my producer, Todd Fisher. Todd has been so instrumental with this podcast even happening. And so today I have him as a guest. And so Todd, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself a little bit?
Hi, Father Dan. Thanks for inviting me to the podcast. It's taken 7 episodes for the producer to be invited, but I'm here. So
saved you for the best one.
Saved me for the last one of the year, but I'm grateful to be here. I really am. Yeah. This has been so fun recording these with you, and you know, kind of the genesis of this was you were a guest on my podcast, and
yes,
I was like, you know, and also on the Religious Hippie on Amber's. You know, I was, yes. I think I produced that one that you did, and I was like, you talk great. We've got to do one. And I just kept pressuring you and you're like, all right, you finally gave in. And these have been so yeah. fun. And I've learned yeah. so much from you. I know the fans love you. So I'm truly grateful to have you this year. And I hope we have many, many, many more of these to go.
For sure. Yes. It's been great. It's always just great to see different questions that we get. And I know, you know, with your podcast and the ones you produce, you've probably seen some very interesting questions. And so, I love doing this too. I think this is something great as a priest that, you know, people have questions and especially for priests, you know? And so I think when people finally get like a captive audience with the priest, I just love actually taking the time to answer questions. And so I know we have a bunch here, so why don't we go ahead and just jump right in?
Sure thing. So the first question is from Hannah Claire. And she asks, who are your role models and why?
All righty. So for my listeners, you guys might remember Hannah Claire. Hannah was actually my guest on the episode for the Greek life, living your Catholic faith in Greek life in college. Let me give a little shout out to Hannah. Hannah, again, thank you for coming on the podcast and thank you for this question. My role models. First is my dad. When I think of all the people in my life I've ever wanted to be like, the first one for me was my dad. I've always said if I could be half the man that he is, I'd be doing pretty well off. My dad's the man who taught me how to be a father, you know, in the way that he loves my mom, showed me what it looks like to be a husband, you know, and so that translates, I think, very well to my ministry as a priest, as being a sharing in the espousement of Christ to the church, and at the same time being a spiritual father, you know, and what does a father do? What sacrifices does he make? How does he provide for his children? That all came from my dad first and foremost. In terms of priests, because I don't think I could pass this question up without mentioning the priests who have been role models for me. The very first one was the priest that baptized me, the first priest that I ever really got to know. And that was Father Thomas Boudary. Father Tommy is a priest of my diocese, and he was the pastor of my hometown for my first 7 years growing up. No, I'm sorry, 8 years. And he baptized me. He gave me my first communion. And also when he was reassigned from our parish, he gave me my first stole that I've held on to. And you know, praise God, now I get to say I can wear as a priest, because he always saw the vocation in at least me or my twin brother, if not both of us. I do have that. And he actually got to vest me at my ordination and preach the homily at my first mass as a celebrant, as a priest. And so he's been a very special priest to me, just with how he ministers. You know, he's always very energetic. My gosh, can that man preach a homily? Just very inspiring, and really planted the seeds of priesthood very deep in me at a very young age. Another priest who's been a role model for me is Father Guy Zerang, who is no longer with us. He passed away 10 years ago. Father Guy was the priest that I really continued like that love of priesthood with. He's the priest that I started altar serving under and served with him up until he was reassigned from our parish as well, but who taught me a great love of the liturgy, and just the way he celebrated Mass was always fantastic. With that, that's really my top three role models, when I think of. I'll add one more in there as well, because I really can't pass up this question without including this one either. And that's my first martial arts teacher, Master Andre Mellum. Master Andre started teaching me Taekwondo when I was 7 years old. And I trained with him up to 2014. And so I trained with him for about 13 years. Just someone who invested so much in me as a kid, and really, you know, trained me in discipline and respect, in learning martial arts, and always just brought out the best in me, has, you know, continued to coach me into my young adulthood. And so always thankful for his teaching, and really helped make me the man that I am today. So that's really my four main role models in life.
That's great. That's great. And Hannah has one more question too.
Yeah.
She asks, what's your favorite part about Catholicism?
Oh, there's so many good things about it. I've always loved the liturgy, and all the things that come with it, because the liturgy is really kind of like our lived expression of the Catholic faith. We get the source and summit of the faith in the Eucharist at the Mass. All the smells, the bells, the colors, there's so much symbolism behind every single little thing that happens at Mass. And again, I think just growing up as an altar server, there's no place I would have rather be. Growing up in altar serving, I remember, you know, I was kind of the one dragging my family out the house because I wanted to get to Mass early so I can go altar serve and get there and get vested and, you know, get mentally prepared. Because for me growing up, there was just something otherworldly about the Mass. It really was an escape from the world. And so just to be able to do that. And, you know, as Christmas and Easter came about, you know, to have these really high feasts that things would change liturgically, and you really pull out all the stops. And, you know, I think the liturgy has always been probably my favorite thing about Catholicism.
That's great. That's great. The next question is from Mallory P97. Recommendations on which order to read the Bible, if any order?
Yeah, definitely. This is a question I get asked a lot. And I'll tell you where not to start first. Do not start with Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. People always think that, they always think that, oh, I'm going to start reading the Bible. And so they open it to the first page, the first chapter. They start with in the beginning, which I'll tell you, in the beginning is probably not where you should start reading the Bible, because most people start with Genesis. They start in the beginning and they maybe get through about the 10th chapter of Genesis and then they just stop. They just get, it, you know, it gets boring. It kind of, you know, gets uninteresting. And so for what order to read the Bible? For Christians, I think first and foremost, start with the Gospels, because it's very difficult to understand the Old Testament if you don't understand Jesus and who he is. He's the center of the faith. Knowing more about Jesus, knowing the life he lived, because when we see how the Gospels portray him, it helps the Old Testament to make more sense.
Because the Old Testament is fulfilled by the New Testament, especially the Gospels. So I'd say start there. Start with the stories of Jesus, you know, the things that he says, the miracles he performs. And so from there, outside the Gospels, I think the book of Psalms is fantastic just for very practical everyday wisdom. There's 150 of them. And in the Psalms, we find every range possible of human emotions. Everyday experiences are found in the Psalms. I guarantee if you're going through something good or bad, there's a Psalm that fits that feeling, that fits the emotions that go with whatever's happening. And so I'd recommend maybe just taking a Psalm a day. You know, there's 150, you know, or maybe two or three a day. In the Liturgy of the Hours that the church prays, you know, as a priest, I pray five offices a day. And some of those offices, there's one Psalm, sometimes there's two, sometimes three. And so we're praying the Psalms all throughout the day. And it's amazing to have those little one-liners of scriptures in the Psalms to kind of help with just getting throughout the day. So I'd start with those two places. With the New Testament, start with the Gospels, and the Old Testament with the book of Psalms.
That's great. That's great. Thank you for that question, Mallory. So I have two questions from two different people here that I think are really kind of interesting to touch on. So let me see here which one I want to do first. So this one is from Marco Barcinas. I may have completely mispronounced that name. I apologize if I did, but he has several questions. So I'm going to do this one. I think this is really interesting. What sources can one cite in Catholic moral theology to justify self-defense? And before you answer that, Father Dan, there's another one here that I think is interesting. Berard Ryan, or possibly Ryan Berard.
Ryan Berard. I know Ryan. Berard? Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Both are first names and last names, probably. Can a Catholic be Daredevil or Batman and still be in good moral standing? So I think these are interesting questions that are kind of like, one's kind of a vigilante, one's kind of self-defense. Maybe you can tackle both these questions at once.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. I think it's great to answer these together. So I'll start with Marco's question first, because I did a whole episode on this one as well. This was, episode 4 or 5 that we did a few months back. That episode is martial arts, Catholic principles of martial arts and self-defense. And so with that question, you know, with self-defense especially, you know, we get a lot of that information from Thomas Aquinas with his natural law theory, and especially the first primary precept of that theory, which is the preservation of human life, especially the idea of self-preservation, but then also preservation of other human life, and the ability and the duty to protect other innocent life. With that, St. Augustine has several just war theories. Aquinas has several just war theories. When we look at, you know, how do we wage any kind of warfare, you know, especially if it's self-defensive warfare. But then also when we get to the principle of devil effect, and this is another Thomistic concept, devil effect is probably one of the most important principles when it comes to, you know, concepts, especially Catholic teachings on self-defense. Because you're looking at all the circumstances, you're looking at means and ends and things like that, and looking at, you know, when you have two effects, one good, one bad, you know, how do you go about navigating, you know, really acting for the good effect and only permitting the bad effect? And so that's really where those sources come from. You can find that in the Summa Theologiae for Thomas Aquinas. I'd probably refer back to that episode on Catholic principles of self-defense. Where I have a lot of those notes there, and I think go into a little bit more detail with that question. Going now from self-defense to the vigilante, you know, Daredevil and Batman, which I always think is so funny to watch Daredevil, and, you know, he's in confession and stuff, and in the church, and it's, you know, kind of, he becomes the thing that he wants to defeat. You know, when I think of, like, the devil, you know, I think of evil and sin and things like that, but here he is as a vigilante, and almost kind of, in a sense, you know, kind of embodying what he wants to defeat, you know, and so he's there, he fights crime and things. And so can Daredevil or Batman be in good moral standing? Again, I think a lot of this comes down to, and maybe I should answer this in the way that Jesus answered some of the Pharisees and stuff, and figures in the Gospels. You know the commandments, you know, when the young rich man comes up and says, "Teacher, what good must I do to inherit eternal life?" And he responds with, "You know the commandments." And so I think with that, that's always a foundation. Are Daredevil and Batman following the commandments? you know, with what they're doing. Are they doing things? And that's the thing, we consider them superheroes. We consider them the good guys. And so I think a lot of this has to do with, you know, what's their intentions? How are they going about what they do? But at the same time, you know, are they actually working, you know, alongside moral authorities, not just for their own intentions, not just for their own motivations? I think the big question for me with vigilantes, are they actually acting for the good of society? And that's where we get into a lot of gray area, you know, with a lot of things. And so, you know, I don't think it's a very definitive answer that goes to this question. Can they be, I'll say this, can they be in good moral standing? I think so. As long as what they're doing goes along with what the church teaches. Again, there's a lot of gray area with that. And so a lot of this is just staying in the commandments, staying in the teachings of the church. But I think certainly they probably could be in good moral standing. It just goes again with what are they doing and how are they doing it?
That's good. Those are interesting answers.
Interesting questions, yeah.
I will just cite from the great books of Marvel and DC for a moment.
Go for it. Yes, go for it.
Daredevil is actually considered the most religious superhero in all of comics.
Right.
So that is kind of an absolute with this. Although Batman, it was revealed that he had given up his Christian faith, and there were several books that were written about that. Okay. But when I was looking, as you were telling the story, I wanted to see how far Marvel went into the rabbit hole of making these backstories of these characters. So this was interesting to me. Captain America, Steve Rogers, is Catholic. Deadpool, who is Wade Wilson, is Catholic. The Hulk, Bruce Banner, is Catholic. Iron Man, Tony Stark, is Catholic. And Spider-Man, Peter Parker, are Catholic. So I did not know that.
Wow.
There has been stuff written in the comics about their religious life.
And you know, it's funny when I, you know, thinking back to the Spider-Man movies that I grew up with, which is the Tobey Maguire movies, you know, seeing his Aunt May like praying the rosary at her bedside, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think that's always interesting to see just how many of them are Catholic. You know, I wonder, I'm gonna have to do some more some more research into, you know, Stan Lee and see, you know, if he was Catholic himself, or, you know, to see if he was not. Then he seems to have had some fascination with the Catholic faith, because he seems to, that's quite a lot of superheroes to say that they're all Catholic.
Or it could add a lot of depth to those characters and how they reconcile doing what they do. When it could be kind of maybe morally questionable.
Yeah.
I have
a feeling that their favorite beatitude is probably blessed are the peacemakers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But interesting. I had no idea. I had to kind of take a deep dive.
Yeah. That's some good stuff. Yeah. That's some really good stuff. Yeah.
So let's see what else we have here. So Drake Fields asks, if you were not a priest, what profession would you choose?
Oh man. D Fields, the flipster himself. Let's see. If I were not a priest, which first of all, I'm very happy as a priest. I love what I get to do. It's a very full and fulfilling ministry. Honestly, I would probably love to be a full-time Taekwondo coach. I'm not just saying that because I'm a huge Cobra Kai fan too, you know, thinking of myself as like a Daniel LaRusso or Johnny Lawrence. But, you know, I've always loved teaching and I've always loved coaching. Even like the refereeing side of martial arts. So I think, you know, and that's one thing too, is a few years ago, I saw that, I think it was the University of Bridgeport, actually had a bachelor's degree in Taekwondo. And so that's something that I remember, this was probably about a decade ago when I was looking at colleges, looking at that and being like, that's pretty cool. Like I could see myself doing that. Am I a freakish athlete? Probably not. I probably wouldn't be more on the competitive side, but I like the coaching aspect. The mentorship, the teaching, especially teaching things like forms and stuff. If not that, obviously I serve in the military now as a chaplain. And so, you know, the military was always something I really aspired to do. But the cool thing is for me, again, as a priest, is I get to do all of those things wrapped into my vocation. And so for me, this is really me living my best life, you know, serving in the military. And also serving as a Taekwondo instructor, you know, that's how I even got this podcast, The Karate Priest, you know, so, yeah.
That's good. I was going to ask that, you know, as a secondary question was, would you have considered, you know, a longer career in the military? Would have been my follow-up.
Maybe, yeah. Sort of maybe a full-time, yeah, maybe like a full-time active duty career, you know. I mean, shoot, even going to what I was doing before the seminary, you know, when I was in college at McNeese State University in Lake Charles, I was studying to be a band director because I love teaching. I love teaching. I love music, you know, and I've always loved that. And for me, especially, I've always loved the competitive side of things. I am a very competitive person. And so for me, I would have loved to have taught at the high school level, especially with marching band, you know, designing shows, especially focusing on drill and visuals and things like that. Because as a military guy, I'm a huge stickler for drill and for marching and just fundamentals. And so, you know, I've always kind of loved that competitive side of things. So that was the plan before seminary, was actually to be a band director.
I noticed you picked a question from me. You know, but I like this question. We're going to answer it because the reason why I like these Q&A episodes is sometimes people haven't listened to the earlier podcasts. So we expect people have been along with us on the ride for a long time, and right. Some of the basics aren't answered for them.
Yeah.
And so that's why I think the Q&As are a great way to go back and explore earlier topics that people might have missed. And this question was, how long does it take to become a priest?
Yeah. So that question that kind of depends on where you start in the process. And so I really, on average, it's going to take somewhere between 6 to 9 years. And the reason for that particular span takes into account, first of all, how much education does the candidate coming into the seminary already have? But then also, what's the expectations, and especially formation expectations, of the particular diocese? Now, this is mostly for diocesan priests. So guys like me who are ordained for a diocese, we would say secular priests, who are not part of religious orders like monks or nuns or things like that. We're not Franciscans or Dominicans. We're simply just a diocesan priest. So for me personally, it took 7 years in the seminary itself. I did my first year of college at McNeese, and so I was actually able to transfer those credits as a sophomore into the college seminary. And so ordinarily for a guy like in my diocese, in Houma-Thibodaux, a guy right out of high school is probably going to take 8 years. He's going to do 4 years of undergraduate work and then a four-year master's degree in theology, or we call it a master's of divinity. My classmate that I was ordained with was in the seminary for 6 years. So he actually got his bachelor's degree at a secular university first, and he entered the seminary. And so he had to do 2 years of what we call pre-theology. That's your 2 years of undergraduate theology and philosophy coursework that's required by canon law. And then he starts his 4 years of graduate school. So that's why we say like 6 to 9 years. And the reason the nine as well is because there's some dioceses who will add either a pastoral year or a spiritual year. Things of that nature. So it's somewhere on the diocesan side, 6 to 9 years. If you join a religious order and want to become a priest, it's normally going to be a little bit longer, maybe even more of like 10 and 11 years. Because in that process, you're not just factoring in your education, but also your commitments to the order, which normally includes some kind of postulancy where you kind of, you know, enter the order just to kind of test it out. You enter the novitiate, to really kind of live that lifestyle, you know, for a period of time before you take your first vows, then your final vows. And then usually after you've made your final vows, they'll allow you to start like the graduate studies. I think like for the Jesuits, it takes somewhere between like 11 to 13 years, you know, if you're right out the gate from high school to become a priest. So again, it all depends on, you know, where you enter, how much education you have coming in, and are you going diocesan or religious?
That's great. Like, I think our listeners really want to hear things like that. I'm also curious on the other end of the spectrum, as you know, we leap you forward another 40 years. What does retirement for a priest look like? Is there an official retirement? Is there a date they don't want you to do it anymore? Do you evolve into other aspects of working in the church and you're not necessarily, you know, in front of people for a Sunday service? Where does the end of the career go? And is there a title for that? Are you a retired priest? This may be a silly question.
Yeah, we actually,
I'm curious about that part.
Yeah. Retirement is a thing for us actually. And for us, you know, we do have an actual retirement age that we're expected to serve to. And then once we hit that retirement age, we can retire if we want. We had some priests who will actually go past the retirement age and give a few more years. In my diocese, I'm trying to remember, it's either 62 or 65, something like that. I think we just increased it for guys ordained after my class. But I think for us, I want to say it's 65. And so I'll be able to retire as a priest at 65. And what retirement looks like for us is you're no longer expected to run a parish. If you, and that's the thing, retirement is a canonical right. It's not like the bishop can say, I'm not letting you retire. By canon law, a priest has a right to retire. And so with that, what retirement looks like is you're not assigned to a parish. You can pretty much live wherever you want. There are some priests that will live outside the diocese. If they want to for retirement, like they can live almost like a state of like, you know, just kind of doing whatever ministry they want. Obviously the bishop would have to approve, but, you know, some priests will get a retirement house by themselves. Some of them have, you know, family homes that, that's willed to them. They can retire to, we do have priest retirement houses where we can have several retired priests living together in community. That way they have each other to rely on. They do have some sense of community and, but from my experience, a lot of retired priests stay active in sacramental ministry. And the reason for that is because once they're retired, they don't have the administrative responsibilities of running a parish anymore. So they get to do all the quote unquote fun stuff again, that you really got ordained to do anyway. Because let's be honest, most priests don't get ordained and don't want to be ordained to do all the administrative work. No one likes having to take care of, you know, hurricane damages and all the nightmare and headaches that come with that, you know, that whole fiasco, dealing with things like that. You know, most priests would rather spend their time doing actual ministry. And so most retired priests in my experience are the ones that, you know, they'll cover mass voluntarily for other priests and receive stipends for doing so. Whenever a priest goes on vacation, which we all have, we're all entitled to, like we, in my diocese, we get 30 days paid vacation a year. So when we go on vacation, usually it's a retired priest will get to come in to celebrate mass. They'll come in and help us with confessions, especially for penance services for Advent, for Lent, or when we have first confessions for the little ones. You know, they help us a lot with those things, or even just with retreats, helping to celebrate masses at schools, especially places that don't have chaplains. You know, a lot of the priests will, those retired priests do a lot of sacramental ministry. So they stay very active in ministry, even though they are retired.
And in retirement, can you still wear a collar? Can you still?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you can.
All that stays the same.
Yeah, yep, that all stays the same. It's really just you're no longer tied to a parish, and you're no longer, wow, you know, responsible for administrative duties.
Interesting. Interesting. Yep. That's great. Thank you for answering that for
oh,
me.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah.
I hope everyone else out there like that. I got. Yeah. So there's another question from Marco here. How do you reconcile Catholicism with the Buddhist Taoist influence?
All righty. Yeah. So that's what I had to do some thinking of. And that's the thing too. I'm glad in the seminary, we actually take some time and study world religions. In fact, in my first year in the seminary, that's one of the courses we took. And so when it comes to Buddhism and Taoism, from my understanding, these aren't so much religions as they are philosophies. I think that that comes from their own doctrines themselves. They don't see themselves as worshiping deities, as much as they see themselves as simply, and maybe this is almost a pun, especially with Taoism, is a way to live. Because if I'm not mistaken, the word Tao means, or sometimes it's pronounced with a D, Dao, means the way.
Yeah.
You know, and I think one of the kind of cornerstone phrases of Taoism is the Tao that can be told is not the eternal Tao, or like the way that can be taught, the way that can be told is not the eternal way. And so it's funny to hear things like that, where like, you know, they have like these philosophies like that. And then you hear Jesus who comes on the scene and says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. So to say, you know, almost like with how Taoism says, you know, this is not the eternal way, but then Jesus says, I am that eternal way, you know. Same thing almost like with Buddhism. And I think I'm a little more familiar with Buddhism than I am with Taoism, you know, especially when it comes to who the Buddha was and kind of his story. You know, this kind of idea of escaping suffering. You know, I think there's a lot of things in Buddhism that are true in terms of like the common situation of most people, you know, that suffering is inevitable, you know, and that's something that we see in a Christian tradition, where Jesus says, you know, you have to take up your cross. And so obviously Jesus is saying, we're not going to escape suffering in this world, you know? And so I think what the Buddha was kind of onto was that, you know, there will be suffering. And the only way to escape suffering is this sense of rebirth. I mean, they would call it reincarnation, you know, or you would be reincarnated until you obtained moksha, which they say is release. Buddhism and Jainism have a lot of the same backgrounds with that, the sense of obtaining the sense of release, or Jainism calls it moksha, the Buddhists call it nirvana. But for us, in essentially, you know, we say the only way to escape suffering is to get to heaven, which I think nirvana, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, Todd, you might know more about this than I do. I think nirvana is really just more of the state of not being at all. Any thoughts on that?
It's also the enlightenment.
Right.
And that's, you know, they've achieved everything they needed to achieve on earth.
Right.
And they're given the option to go off to their version of heaven, or to not exist anymore, or to choose to come back and cyclically do it again. You're given right. that choice with Buddhists. You know, at the beginning, you mentioned the philosophy part, and this comparative religious study is really some of my expertise, but it's very interesting to me that there's a difference between academia and the practitioners of Buddhism in terms of what they do call it, because many will call it a religion, many call it a philosophy. So it's there's even a little, it's distinctively different depending on who you talk to and how they consider it, which is interesting. But I think, you know, the question is really about reconciling, which to me implies how to coexist in some form of harmony right. with this. And I think, you know, this could be said for the Jewish faith or any number of other things. You know, how do we all be in the same room together without wanting to, you know, feud? But I think using Buddhism as an example, like the two main differences really, you know, come down to the Buddhists don't really believe in a God, for one. So that's a huge difference that we right. have to kind of get yeah. past to function with someone right. who is Buddhist. And the other is the idea of reincarnation. And yeah. I think if we boil it down, those are really the two main points. So the real question here is, how do we reconcile existing in some form of harmony with that? What yeah. is the Catholic perspective on that, you know?
Yeah. So this is where, for further reading, I would recommend anybody read, and these are the two documents that we really looked at when I took this course in the seminary, is Nostra Aetate, and then also Dominus Jesus, which kind of, I think Nostra Aetate especially goes into kind of like Catholic relations with various world religions. And so it goes into, like, you know, how we see our relationship with Judaism, with Islam, with Buddhism. And so I would really, you know, kind of forward a reader to look into those things for further reading. As far as, you know, reconciliation, you know, that's the thing. There's never going to be really a full reconciliation really until we come to an agreement, you know. But that's the thing, is I think there's a lot of things in, like, especially Buddhism, that I think can lead one to belief in Christ, you know, that can lead one to cross that bridge from, you know, again, this being it's not a deistic religion for them, Buddhism. And so to go from, to see that, and to say that Jesus kind of fulfills that, to say that, all right, the Buddha was not a God, but there is one, you know? Right. And so to say that, you know, cause I think there's something that I can't remember exactly what, but like the Buddha almost saying that, like, you know, that I am not I am not God, like I'm not the creator, you know? And so I think in a sense that maybe in Buddhism would leave something wanting of wanting to know a creator and kind of looking maybe from a cosmological perspective of how the universe is created, and to see that there's a higher power that must have created something, you know, and that's getting into a lot of cosmology again. I think there's a lot that can lead to Catholicism from Buddhism, like the Eightfold Path, you know, kind of like the things you have to do, you know. I kind of go back to Matthew 19:17, where the guy says, the young man says, teacher, what good must I do to inherit eternal life? You know, and kind of like there's a way, there is practical things, you know. We have the Beatitudes, you know, we have the commandments, you know, we have practical things, kind of like what the Eightfold Path does, is kind of lay out a path. It lays out a way, and maybe that's where Taoism kind of comes in as well, to say that Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, as kind of like a fulfillment of all these things that's wanting in these religions.
Yeah, I agree with that a lot. I know a lot of people that their minds were first open to the idea of higher powers and wanting to move into an organized religion more by skirting through philosophies like this.
Yeah.
And I think that it was for a lot of people that were agnostic, it was sort of leading them there. And maybe that path was through Buddhism or something else, even through things like Hinduism, and how that informs itself into even yoga today, depending on not yeah. the, you know, strip mall type yoga, that type yeah. of fitness center, but like, when you get into that, really that spiritual aspect of that, it steers people toward God, it steers people toward religion, and they ultimately make a choice to move toward it. So I think it's interesting to think of it that way.
And maybe in terms of like catechesis as well, you know, I think of how St. Paul really kind of catechized his audience, which he was, we say he's the apostle to the Gentiles, you know. And so you see in Paul's writings, the New Testament, his epistles, using like the religion of the people he's talking to, and to kind of make these parallelisms that ultimately lead one to believe that, okay, you see how you believe X? Well, this is how Christ actually fulfills that, you know? And so to kind of like, to actually build that bridge from one belief to the other, I think is maybe how that could work. And maybe that requires something like Cyril of Jerusalem with his mystagogical catechesis, is to kind of show people like a concrete example and show them how this is parallel to, and then ultimately leading to a fulfillment for something in Catholicism. That's, I guess, in terms of the reconciliation part, that's how I would probably see that.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, our last question is from our friend Amber,
the religious hippie. Oh, yeah. Oh, I love Amber. Yep.
And she asks, how to navigate dating for a dateless generation?
Oh, boy.
You have to answer this because you're closer to her age than I am.
Yeah, really. I think I like how she uses that word dateless generation. I think dating has become a lost art, and maybe the concept of it. You know, I'm a little bit more of an old fashioned guy where, you know, when I think of dating, I think of almost like really courtship, you know. I think there's this is such an open-ended question. There's so many ways we can go about this. I think one of the first things when it comes to dating, the first thing you should remember is you're not married yet. Because I think when you live in the reality of where you are, not where you want to be, I think the expectations become a lot clearer. You know, I think we have a culture that wants to live as if it's married. Like a dating culture specifically, a dating culture that wants to live as if it's married. And yet when things don't work out, wonder, well, what went wrong? You know, and I think with that comes the fact that, well, especially in terms of, you know, civil is one thing, but like when you look at like the sacrament of matrimony, you were living in a particular state that you didn't have the sacrament to give you the graces to live that particular state, to live that vocation. And so with that, you know, I think that's one of the first and foremost things is for couples, dating couples, to remember you are not married yet. And this is the thing too, in my experience as a priest and working with married couples and engaged couples, leading them to the altar, is I've seen engagements end. You know, you think that it's not going to happen to us, you know? And this is why too, you know, and most people know that the church is avidly against cohabiting. You know, couples who are not married living together. And there's a wisdom behind that, you know, it's not to be prude, but there's really this kind of practical thing. And I've actually heard, you know, a couple say this recently that before they were married, they were living together. And they said they regretted it. They actually regretted that decision to live together because they thought, and they said that this was probably naive. They thought that marriage would fix the problems they saw in each other before they were married. Now, in my experience, and I suspect this is the same for people dating as it is for seminarians, that as the seminarian, so the priest. What you do in the seminary, how you are in the seminary, often shows how you will be as a priest. So let's say, for example, for me in the seminary, you know, or any seminarian, if you're not praying the Liturgy of the Hours as a seminarian, if you don't develop that habit before ordination, more than likely you're not going to develop that habit as a priest, or it might take longer. Same thing with marriage. Like, you know, if you're living with your significant other and there's something that you don't like about the way that they do something when you're living with them now, what makes you think marriage is going to fix that? You know, so I think a lot of this has to do with living in that reality that you are not yet married. And until you actually stand at the altar, because we've all heard of stories of people leaving each other at the altar, until you actually, you know, say the words, say the vows, and it's in that consent is received by the minister, you know, until that moment, live as if you are not married, even if you're engaged, because I've seen engagements being broken off, you know, and that's the thing, is people always get into sticky situations where they're trying to weasel their, not say weasel, but they're really trying to fight their way out because they've dug the hole so deep. I think really keep it simple. I think by keeping dating simple, you know, keeping the dates themselves simple, keeping the emotion simple, really helps to develop intimacy on levels that are not physical. I think one thing that couples need to focus on while they're dating is developing intimacy in ways that are not physical, because things tend to come full circle as well. As you get older, especially for married couples, you know, what I've seen is that the physical, the sexual drive tends to drop off in one partner or the other. And then when that physical intimacy is not what it used to be, then what's left? You know, do you have the intimacy developed spiritually, emotionally, psychologically, that you can use, you can fall back on, because otherwise you have nothing. And so I think that's what happens nowadays too. We're so caught up in the physical, in aesthetic, aesthetics, that we tend to, those tend to be more superficial. And so we really need to focus more on developing spiritual intimacy. Can you pray together as a couple? Emotional intimacy. Are you able to listen to each other? Can you relate to where you're actually listening and receiving what someone's saying and loving them in that space? And then also I would say, recognizing love for what it is, and distinguishing between love as an action and infatuation, which is an emotion, a feeling. That love isn't so much a feeling as it is an action. It's love is not always butterflies and flowers. And, you know, my uncle said one time that sometimes for him, marriage is like having hornets in your stomach, you know? So he says, not like having butterflies, it's the opposite. You know, when we look at Jesus and how he loved, the greatest act of love ever on the face of the earth was an instrument of execution, an instrument of death. And so I think we have to really be honest with ourselves, first of all, of what love is, you know, and what is love is not just baby, don't hurt me. But realizing also the reality of we're not yet married, that this is a step to discern that, that vocation and that call. There's so many ways we can go about this. That could be a whole other episode itself on Catholic dating. Amber, I might have to get with you on this one if you're listening to this episode.
Might be our Valentine's Day episode, right?
Hey, we could do a collab episode maybe and release it on both of our podcasts.
That's right, Amber. So if you're listening to this, we're going to do that. It's going to be a going to be an event that covers three podcasts.
That would be cool. A joint release.
Yeah, it's like they do that with TV shows, right? Same characters are on all three shows. I have a kind of follow-up question to that, though. Do you think there's a certain amount of time people should spend together? Is there a sweet spot for the relationship when an amount of time maybe they need before marriage? Or do you believe in kind of the smitten bolt of lightning movie style, they knew in 3 days they'd be married forever? Like, is there...
No, for me, usually I don't think there's like the bolt lightning moment. I mean, there's some couples that I know that, you know, from the first time they saw each other, they just knew.
Yeah.
But those are couples that I find that that things unfolded very organically. For me, what I really encourage my couples is to, especially before you even start talking about marriage, have you made it out of the honeymoon phase yet? Do you guys know how to love each other through hardship? Have you, because in my experience, like if a couple has absolutely zero hardships, that by the time they, let's say they were to get married, when the first hardship comes, they often don't know how to deal with it because they've never had to deal with it before as a couple. You know, so if you have arguments as a couple, if you have disagreements, in my opinion, fantastic. Because that means that you're learning how to compromise. You're learning how to love each other in pains. When things are not good, because, you know, when we look at especially the vows in the Catholic Church, you know, I promise to be true to you in good times and in bad, in sickness and in health. And there will be all four of those things, good times, bad times, sickness, health. If you do not know how to love each other in bad times and in sickness, you're going to have a very hard time. And so for me, there's not a specific time frame. I would just say that, you know, I would ask a couple, you know, have you been through hardships together? You know, because for me, that's not something to be a red flag. If they have had difficulties, to me, that says that they've been tested.
Do you believe that there's more temptation these days on relationships than there were maybe 50 years ago?
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, where the media has taken us at this point. We've become a people who are so much concerned with our public perception and what we put out. that many times that the people that we, that the first thing, the first kind of image we see of somebody is not the reality. Then we tend to have to, you know, I find we tend to get heartbroken when what we saw at first is not what's there on the inside, is not what's underneath. So I think there's a lot more superficiality that happens today. I think when you look at things like media as well, one thing that kills relationships more than anything else at this point is probably really two things, pornography. And this also kind of goes hand in hand with the second thing, and that's just marital infidelity. You know, and I think a lot of that happens because of a lack of authentic intimacy. Kind of going back to that again, you know, why are couples sometimes not being faithful to each other? They're looking for intimacy and they're finding it in somebody else who is not their spouse. And so when that need for intimacy is filled, there's no need to go find it somewhere else. And so the two sources that need to, that can fill that intimacy is first and foremost with God and then with the spouse, you know? And so that's the thing. If there's something wanting there, then you, that's where you have to sit down in your marriage and first of all, pray together, you know, involve God in that discussion, then figure out, you know, how can that marriage grow and how can you continue to find the intimacy that you need? And I think this kind of goes back to like the love languages, and maybe you've, you know, heard about this as well. This is, I think Gary Chapman's the guy's name, who wrote the book on the five love languages, you know, a lot of this figuring out how to express love in a way that the person is able to receive it. Some people have a different giving language than their receiving language. But I think that's a lot to do with it. There's so much self-knowledge that goes into these relationships that I think you really have to take all that into account. And then that helps with temptation. That helps with things like sin, to go back to that question.
That's a great answer.
The more you know yourself, the more you know how you can ward off and fight off different sins and temptations.
What's the church's stance on people that just want to remain a couple rather than marry? Is there a stance on that? Can a person just be in a monogamous relationship with someone for 40 years and not marry, or is there a push to be married?
There are definitely, the idea is that dating, the goal in the end of dating, is marriage, is to discern marriage. You either date to discern marriage, or you just remain single. You know, we recognize that singleness as a vocation is a valid vocation. It's not to say you're perpetually dating. If you're single, then there's supposed to be some sense of permanence and commitment to every single vocation. And so with that, you know, the ideas the church would say, you know, dating, the point of dating is to discern marriage. And so if you're dating, that should be like, that should be the thing guiding the relationship, is the sense of vocation. Because otherwise, you know, where's the permanence? There has to be a sense of permanence and commitment, and that's lacking in many relationships. Like if you're going to stay together the rest of your life, well, then you actually need the graces of the sacrament to do that. Otherwise, you're kind of working against grace in this situation. So
right. Okay, Amber, do you got all that?
I know that was a long weekend. That deserves a whole episode.
There is for sure. Well, Father Dan, that's all the questions we have for this year. So
all righty, sounds good.
This has been a lot of fun. It really has been.
Yeah, it's been great to get into this. And again, Todd, thank you for this invitation. And it's amazing how this happened in the span of a year, just meeting you a year ago. And now here we are at the end of this next year. And
we'll have more podcasts, because this year we got derailed a little bit. The hurricane put us behind.
Yeah,
we probably had four or five more.
Yep. So, we'll definitely have some more interviews coming up soon in the future. And especially some very interesting characters that you know, I've come across, you know, back home, and you know, just to cover different topics. So,
Well, I appreciate all of these episodes this year. I look forward to more. This has been a really wonderful year. And I definitely thank the listeners, and I'm going to turn it over to you to take it out.
All right. Sounds good. Yes. Again, everybody, thank you so much for tuning into this podcast and helping to make this first few months of this podcast really the success that it is. All your questions, your support for the people who've been on for interviews, a huge thanks goes out to them. And so with that, I wish you all a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. We'll see you guys in 2022.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of The Karate Priest. If you enjoyed this podcast, go ahead and like The Karate Priest on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, and subscribe to the YouTube channel. If you're ever in South Louisiana, come visit me at the Cathedral of St. Francis de Sales in Houma. If you have any questions or comments about the show, you can also email me at thekaratepriest@gmail.com. Your questions are welcomed and may be used in future episodes. May the blessing of Almighty God, the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit come down on you and remain with you forever. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Please be sure to rate and review this episode. This podcast is produced by Todd Fisher and distributed by Metacortex Publishing. This podcast is copyright. Any previously trademarked or copyright content is used by permission. Information and opinions stated in this podcast should not be construed as medical advice. Please be sure to visit the official website for the International Association of Metatomics at metatomics.org or find us on social media for other unique content.